Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. You're probably well aware, but the Sacramento region is growing. In recent years, the counties that surround the state capital have become an increasingly desirable place to call home in California. But with growth comes different needs in pursuit of livability. Valley Vision is a regional organization focused on creating livable communities with research to in turn shape into action. In collaboration with Sacramento State's Institute of Social Research, a new report pulled the needs of residents across six counties: Sacramento, Yolo, El Dorado, Placer, Yuba, and Sutter counties, as well as how they viewed the changing region. And some of the big concerns likely won't come as a surprise, from housing to affordability and public transportation. The data is being used by the Sacramento Area Council of Governments to better understand how to plan for the region's future as it develops and grows. Joining us is Evan Schmidt, Valley Vision's Executive Director, as well as James Corliss with the Sacramento Area Council of Governments. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Vicki.
Okay, Evan, what is a built environment? Because that's the name of the poll.
Absolutely. Well, the built environment is everything you see in your communities every day. It's really the ways that our houses, our transportation, our businesses, our open space and parks, our sidewalks, all of those things are easy to take for granted, but they really make up our daily lives and are really important when we think about planning and design.
Yeah, I mean, in order for a poll to be effective, it really comes down to the types of questions that are asked, who you're polling, the methodology, and all of that. What conversations did you have to creating this poll to get the most results and the most accurate picture of what residents in these six counties are facing?
Well, with our partner, the Institute of Social Research at Sac State, we have a panel of over 3,000 respondents from across the six county regions, as you mentioned. And from that panel, we have, for this particular poll, we had over 1,500 people answer. And the way that we do the polls is we make sure that we have a valid margin of error, and we weight it to match the demographics of our region. So we have a margin of error of less than 3%, and we're very confident that the responses that we're seeing in this poll really do truly reflect the views of the people in our region.
What were some of the questions that were asked?
We asked about housing preferences, as well as their experiences around affordability. We asked about their transportation practices and their opinions and perceptions about transportation. We asked things about their neighborhoods, including things like the sidewalks and the amenities and the parks. So we really wanted to get into what are some of the details of the built environment, both in terms of people's experiences and their opinions.
James, the Sacramento Area Council of Governments, or SACOG, right? For short, it's a pretty lengthy
name. Sure everybody knows the name.
Yeah, SACOG, exactly.
However you want to say it.
I mean, you represent a couple dozen plus, you know, local governments. Is there a gap in this information currently to help shape these local governments in how they want to grow their area and their communities?
I don't know there's a gap in how local governments view this. So one of the things that we do, pulling all the governments together, is plan for the future. So we're actually developing a plan right now we're calling Blueprint that looks out to 2050, so 25 years into the future. And I'd say many of our local governments actually understand we're fast growing. We have to accommodate people. We have to address the affordability crisis. We know traffic congestion is a major concern. But the question is, it's not if we grow, it's how, right? It's how we shape that growth and take some of the results of this poll that Valley Vision's just conducted and make sure we're listening to the needs of residents, the desires of residents, while still thinking about how will life be different in 5, 10, 25 years?
When you talk to local governments that you work with and collaborate with in the last 5 or 10 years, I mean, how have their communities changed?
Well, I think if you go back 15 years ago, we got really hit in the Great Recession. We as a metropolitan region probably took the biggest dive. And what happened, we were building a lot of housing from 2001 to 2008. Great Recession hit. And we took one of the biggest nosedives of any region in the country. So we really, housing really almost stopped to a trickle. Now we're very behind. So one of the things the poll is suggesting, and our local governments see this as well, is we are beginning to build more housing, although now inflation, interest rates, right? So we're way behind. We dug ourselves into a hole in the 2010s. And if we're going to accommodate our future growth, we have to build a lot more housing and provide more housing choices.
Yeah, Evan, the six counties that you polled, I mean, they all are unique. They have different demographics and socioeconomics, Sacramento, Yolo, El Dorado, Placer, Yuba, and Sutter counties. Where was their consensus in their responses?
Well, when we're looking at different housing types, we do see a lot of a majority of people noting that they would like to live in single family homes. But across our six counties, we had a full 36% of our respondents who said they are more interested in living in neighborhoods where there's more things like apartments, condos, duplexes, these attached housing products. And when you look at that percentage, that 36% who say they would, that's what they would like to see, that compares to actually 31% of what's available right now in those types of housing products. So even if you look at and say, oh, a majority of people want single family homes, that 36%, that amount that want those attached housing products is still underrepresented in what we actually have. And then another lens that we looked at was homeowners versus renters. And across the board, across all of our counties, those two groups have very different views of what they're looking for. And renters tended to want to see more infill development, more of that attached housing development, as well as kind of more leaning into housing growth in order to address this gap and this housing crisis that we're seeing.
So, James, how do you take this information and turn it into action?
Well, we're developing, as I said, Vicki, a long-range plan now called the Blueprint. In fact, if people want to go to our website, it's sacog.org. You can take a survey. So we're going to be pulling the results of this poll. We're doing focus groups. We're doing a big workshop coming up next month. And that's all going to get sort of fed into a strategy for how we grow in the region. And among the challenges we have, well, one challenge I'd love to talk about is clearly we have an affordability challenge in the region for housing. But we also have a majority of people saying, we want to slow down housing growth, right, and housing production. So those two things are a challenge. But we also have a challenge in funding and money and resources. We are not a region with a huge checkbook. We would love to build things like light rail to the airport or housing everywhere, but we have to be smarter about how we grow, about the kind of housing we produce, right, and the transportation and traffic congestion and providing people options. We've got to be much more cost-effective in how we deploy our investments.
You bring up a really big point, because I think it's pretty much generally understood that we have a housing problem. We have an affordability issue in this state and in this region. But the questions that you're asking really highlight that it impacts each individual or each household differently. They have different needs and different challenges.
Oh, absolutely. And I think James brings up an interesting point, too, about the majority wanting to slow down growth. When we asked the same, we asked the question, would you like to see housing development speed up to accommodate the needs we have, or would you like to see housing development slow down because neighborhoods are moving too fast? We had 52% saying they want to see it slow down. But when you look at these unique different subgroups, that changed a lot. So renters, that went all the way up to, I think it was 64% wanted to see development speed up. We also saw that it within cities as opposed to suburban or rural communities. So there's a lot of differences across different communities and different populations.
Hmm. Public transportation is a big one because there are six counties, but it is pretty common to live in a county and then commute to work in another county, right? Public transportation, has been a challenge. You know, I mean, it would be great to have a light rail to the airport, right, James? But what did you hear from residents about what they want? I would imagine there's an over-reliance on vehicles.
Absolutely. There is 93% noted that they rely on their personal vehicle primarily for their commute. But there's a few different things about that. One is commute patterns have changed so much since the pandemic. Yeah. So we saw this swing from pre-pandemic, 50% of people said they commuted 4 days or less. That's up to 93% of people said they commuted 4 days or less into their commute. So there's a lot more variability of people going in once a week, twice a week, maybe no times a week. And that really influences the way people use things like public transit. So yes, there's changing commuting patterns. There's a reliance on personal vehicles. And there's actually quite a bit of other modes of transportation that people are using, including walking, public transit, biking, rideshare, and others. And when you look kind of down the line at those other, although they're minority numbers, they do represent a significant amount of people. And Then, even in the people who said they rely on their personal vehicles, there was a significant amount of people who said they would use public transit more if they were safer, cleaner, or took less time. So these are all areas where there's opportunity to either change behavior or really maximize some of these other modes that people aren't using at this moment as much.
James, what are you hearing about public transportation and how it's evolved in recent years?
Well, also the good news in the poll is actually public transportation has a pretty good the respondent said, hey, I think it's sort of gotten a little bit better, right? And I give a lot of credit to our public transportation providers, Sacramento Regional Transit, Yolo Transit District. But the pandemic has changed things, right? It has changed so much. One is we don't have any big downtown jobs anymore, right? So we lost a lot of ridership. It's slowly coming back. So people are traveling as much as they did before the pandemic, but differently. So one thing about light rail to the airport, as much as I love that idea of the sleek train pulling in, it's light rail is not flexible. It's very costly. It only runs where it runs. We could actually make buses work quicker and faster and more reliably by dedicated lanes, traffic signals that are smarter. And now we're looking at a lot of big data about where people travel. And we're trying to use this big data to look at if there are some regional transit routes, as well as services that are more local in the neighborhood called microtransit, where you basically go to an app and you call up and you go from point to point. And it's a van of about 6 to 8 passengers. And it gives you point to point. It's called Smart Ride here in Sacramento County. It's very popular, right? So it's a little bit of things like that where we have to be dynamic and we have to be innovative. And again, I give a lot of credit to our public transportation providers that are testing out these new kind of point to point, on demand, consumer driven kinds of services.
Evan, was there anything in the poll that surprised you?
There was a number of things that surprised me, and I mentioned the majority of people wanting to slow down growth. But although I think some of the numbers that really popped out for me were around affordability. So we had 79% of people think that first-time home buyers will have more trouble buying homes in the next 5 years. We had 64% cite affordability as their biggest concern about growth in our region, and a full 52% of renters who said their neighborhoods aren't affordable. So to me, there's a lot of kind of writing on the wall that really confirms what we've already been hearing about housing affordability. And then it's always really important to remember as well, the cost burden of housing doesn't affect every population equally. So if you look at the racial demographics, we know that communities of color are more cost burdened than others. So the intensity of some of those numbers, I don't know that it surprised me, but it certainly jumped out to me as a really serious concern.
What stood out to you about the poll?
I think this quandary between people really citing affordability and lack of affordability in housing and the desire to not build more. So I think we've got a lot of work to do as local governments and public servants to really try to engage the public to understand that we need to build more housing. We need to build more housing also that is attached and multifamily and affordable. And frankly, there's a lot of our older areas, our commercial corridors or old strip malls, where we can actually re-envision and reimagine those. And we have a program called Green Means Go that's all about speeding up kind of environmentally friendly housing where people don't have to drive as much. They can hop on that bus. They can get things that are within walking distance. And I think what alarms me and I think it should alarm all of us, is the lack of affordable homeownership opportunities. Because as Evan just mentioned, the racial wealth gap in housing is significant and growing in the region. And it seems like the starting price point is $700 or more in the region these days. And there isn't something that used to exist 20, 30, 40 years ago, which is the starter home.
The starter home. Yeah. I mean, that's non-existent. You know, and that's the time of like my parents, you know, which is a completely different generation. I have so many friends that tried to get into their first home, especially during the pandemic, and offer after offer after offer just fell through, right? You have all cash offers and we know the record low interest rate. So I understand that. When it comes to our region, because this isn't just an isolated issue, right? How do we compare to other regions in the state, or are there comparable regions in the country that you can look to as for advice or collaborate with for solutions?
Yeah, and I love this question because I think, and I moved to the Sacramento region 6 years ago, and I used to live in the Bay Area. We always seem to compare ourselves to the Bay Area, but it's not a good comparison. Our comparators are more Salt Lake City, Denver, Nashville, Indianapolis, Raleigh, Durham, those mid-sized regions. And frankly, those mid-sized regions are kind of the future economically. A lot of young people are moving just there as they're moving here. The The challenge that we will always have, among others, is that we are right in that sort of satellite orbit of the Bay Area. So our housing costs have risen over time and fallen, but risen more than they've fallen because, in part, because of the salaries of the Bay Area. And I don't think we'll ever be the affordable option anymore to the Bay. So we have an inland Central Valley economy, right, with a sort of a workforce now that is more combined and flows back and forth with the Bay Area. We're probably akin to a number of those regions I mentioned, and we need to learn from those. The Metropolitan Chamber here does a lot of great study missions to those mid-sized regions, and that's where frankly, we need to go across the Sierras and look out into the West and the Midwest for a lot of our comparison regions.
In some cases, across the country.
True.
If you're talking about North Carolina. Finally, what would you like listeners to take away from this poll when they take it in for themselves this week? Evan?
Well, building off what James was just talking about worker mobility, this idea that people are less tied to their workplaces than they've ever been before, and how important it is, and this for Valley Vision coming back to livability, how important it is for our region to be a region of choice for people. And to do that, we need to be planning for the future, really thinking carefully about affordable housing, about how we're building and planning, and how we're building our transportation system. So, you know, these issues of built environment, they affect our livability so much. And so this is really an important moment to be having this dialogue and to be really thinking about how it is that we want to grow, because things have changed in the last few years so very dramatically. And there's a lot of work to do to make sure that we really stay this high quality of life region, which I really think we are. Not just for today, but for generations in the future.
How about you, James?
Yeah, we think about the plan we're doing out to 2050. So high school students today will be in their early 40s. And I think what we have to ask ourselves is, how do we make sure that everybody who wants to stay here can afford to stay here? And how, as Evan said, the very thing that is having a lot of Bay Area folks move up here, the unhitched from work, remote work, is also potentially going to allow people to leave here. And all of the people that we actually want to stay, our families, our kids, our grandchildren. So we have to be this region of choice. Things like a regional bike trail network that, you know, heretofore seemed like kind of, that would be nice to have. It's a must have now. So these kinds of quality life, transportation, housing options, these are must haves for us.
James and Evan, thanks for the time.
Thank you. You're so welcome.
A lot of information. Evan Schmidt is Valley Vision's executive director, and James Corliss is with the Sacramento Area Council of Governments. They're discussing the Built Environment Poll, which shared the needs of residents across six counties, Sacramento, Yolo, El Dorado, Placer, Yuba, and Sutter, as well as how they view the growing region. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. On the rolling hills outside the Central Valley community of Patterson, Governor Gavin Newsom unveiled a plan to build California's green future faster, an effort he says hasn't been attempted in half a century. With the help from federal funding, Newsom says the state is committed to investing up to $180 billion in infrastructure projects he says will create hundreds of thousands of jobs and meet the state's lofty climate goals. But a major component of the 11 bills and one executive order he announced are plans to amend one of California's most consequential and controversial environmental laws, the California Environmental Equality Act, or CEQA. Newsom says the changes to the environmental laws mean California could complete ambitious projects more quickly, save the state money by streamlining the permitting process, as well as limit the length of legal battles in court without compromising the environment. But some environmental groups criticize the governor's proposals, claiming that expediting the environmental review and legal process could have unintended consequences for underserved communities and the ecosystems they're fighting to protect. Joining us to explain these proposals and the challenges that they face is UC Davis Law Professor Christopher Elmendorf, an expert in property and land use law. Good morning.
Good morning. It's nice to be here.
Thanks for making the time. Professor Elmendorf, what was your initial reaction to the nearly dozen of proposals and executive order that the governor announced last week on Friday in Stanislaus County?
Well, I think the most important thing is that the governor is paying attention to the problem. And I see this package as a first shot, a first proposal for how to deal with the problems and how to put California back into a place where it can do big things again. But whether this package will be enough, I think, is very much an open question. And with respect to the California Environmental Quality Act specifically, I think it would be fair to say this package makes very, very, very minor changes. Mm.
You know, people may not be aware, but why does California have an infrastructure problem?
Well, California built a lot of roads and a lot of dams, some of which were good and some of which were bad. Some projects were used in a very abusive way, particularly in urban areas where African-American communities were targeted and broken up through urban renewal projects, often with highways. There was a reaction to that, and that reaction happened both nationally and at the state level. And we saw in 1969 and 1970, the passage first of the National Environmental Quality Act at the national level, and then a year later, the California Environmental Quality Act at the state level. And both of these laws had very laudable aspirations. The core idea is that before the government undertakes a project that may significantly affect the environment, or before the government approves a private project that may significantly affect the environment, the government should do a study and look at alternatives to the proposed project and weigh the environmental benefits and costs of the different alternatives and then choose a reasonable one and mitigate unavoidable impacts to the extent that that is feasible. It's a simple, common sense idea. Of course, we want to study things before we make irreversible decisions. But that common sense idea was paired with an authorization for pretty much any person who has any objection to a project to go into court and to identify some arguable flaw in the environmental study and ask a judge to order the study redone and to put the project on hold while the study is redone. So it combined a very sensible planning process with a arguably less sensible right to delay projects when any random person has an objection to the planning process. And over time, there developed a body of law which required more and more elaborate studies and created more and more hooks for a plaintiff to say, oh, you know, that's part of the study could have been done differently or better. And the result is both a really significant risk of delay, and also because of that significant risk of delay, a very strong incentive for any group that wants a payoff, be they a labor union or a community group or what have you, whether their interests are environmental or not, any group that wants a payoff to become expert in how this law operates so they can threaten to delay a project until they're paid off.
Yeah. And the delay is costly, right? By drawing out a project. I mean, if you're a developer or you're trying to build this infrastructure or even housing, I mean, it can almost become financially impossible by the time you're done with all the litigation.
Or you choose to build in places where there aren't neighbors or there aren't organized groups who would oppose it. Now, for some things, it becomes very hard to choose alternative locations, but even high speed rail, which every environmentalist celebrates in the abstract, at least, is not being built down the peninsula. Why is it not being built down the peninsula? Well, because the good people of Atherton decided they didn't want the trains going through their town. And they used the California Environmental Quality Act to delay the project. And they had enough resources that ultimately the project was routed somewhere else.
So you're just really hitting home a criticism, a core criticism of CEQA, which became law more than 50 years ago in 1970. The intentions were good, but, you know, over the decades, it's being criticized as being weaponized against building in some infrastructure projects. So when it comes to this package of proposals, this plan that the governor proposed on Friday, what impact could this have to CEQA?
So the package of proposals with respect to CEQA, as I said, is quite narrow. It does two things. One, it creates a procedure building on an existing procedure that allows the governor or agency heads who are working for the governor to certify a project as a environmental priority project, a priority infrastructure project, a priority microchips project, a priority water project. And once that project has that certification, the agency who is preparing the environmental study has to take a few more steps in preparing that study so it's all ready for a court to review. And then if or when that project is challenged in court, the court is supposed to decide within 270 days, 9 months, whether the environmental review was sufficient. But there's not actually a mechanism to force a court to decide within that period. It's really more of an exhortation to the court to try to speed this up if they can. So probably the most significant effect of that reform is just to allow the governor to put his or her stamp of approval on a project, either directly or through an agency head, as a way of signaling to a court, come on, don't mess this one up. Let this project go forward. You know, if you think it's a close case under CEQA, give it the benefit of the doubt. So that's one thing the proposal does. The other thing the proposal does is it tries to limit in a very small way this thing called the administrative record. The administrative record is the body of information that was before the agency that approved the project at the time they approved it. And it's that body of information that a court is supposed to consider and only that body of information in a challenge to the environmental review. And under existing law, every single email or other communication between members of the agency that were involved in preparing the environmental study is declared to be part of the administrative record. So there's often a lot of litigation and fighting over what emails were sent and have to be included, and are they have they all really all been found? And that fight to create that administrative record delays the CEQA litigation process further. And so the governor's proposal says internal communications among members of an agency that are undertaking a project don't count as part of the administrative record.
Hmm. The fact that you said that these proposals in terms of CEQA, you know, it's pretty minor changes. Does that highlight or underscore the challenges of having CEQA meet the needs of today as opposed to, you know, when it became a law more than 50 years ago? Because I imagine this isn't the first governor that's tried this.
Yeah, I think that's true. So if you go back to 2015 or 2016, Governor Jerry Brown proposed something that I think most people would say was an absolute common sense CEQA reform. Jerry Brown's idea was for housing specifically, his proposal was that if a housing project complies with the local government's zoning and land use plan, and if that zoning and that land use plan has already undergone a CEQA review, then the individual housing project should not also have to undergo an additional CEQA review because that's redundant. And that seems totally commonsensical. But it turns out that the real money in CEQA is not about litigating cities' general plans. The real money in CEQA is about litigating individual housing approvals. Why? Because there you've got a developer who potentially can be extorted into paying off the group that is bringing the litigation. And so that Jerry Brown plan was vehemently opposed by the building trade unions. And every single CEQA reform that we have seen since, or virtually every CEQA reform that we have seen since that limits CEQA review, couples that limitation with a requirement that the developer hire union workers or pay above market wages that have been negotiated by labor unions. So that's an example of how the law has been transformed from something that was primarily concerned with environmental protection to, in operation, something that is primarily concerned with the distribution of the potential surplus, such as it were, associated with a particular project.
When it comes to this package of proposals, there's also criticism from a number of environmental groups. I mean, the Sierra Club, the Center for Biological Diversity, and Restore the Delta, which adamantly opposes the state's Delta Tunnel project. I mean, they said in a statement that Governor Newsom does not respect the people in communities that need environmental protection, end quote. Is there weight behind this, that these proposals could potentially be detrimental to communities or even the state's environment?
I don't want to speak specifically to the Delta proposal. I don't feel like I understand the details of those of that proposal well enough to address that. I will say that I think there's a question about whether the environment is better protected through politics or whether it's better protected through litigation and delay. And there are people who are of the view, maybe grounded in their own experience with litigation, that the best way to protect the environment is to be able to delay a project that I don't like or anybody doesn't like, because that's really how it works today. And then that threat of delay can be used to negotiate maybe a change in the project that makes it more to the liking of the person who can credibly threaten to sue. And there's other people who think that the way the environment is going to be protected is by building the things that we need, for example, to support the clean energy transition. And people who have that perspective tend to think not that we shouldn't do environmental reviews, but that environmental reviews shouldn't be coupled with a right of delay that any single objector to a project can invoke. And I think in that criticism from environmental groups that are sort of expert CEQA litigators, I think you see that that philosophical difference.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. We've been speaking with UC Davis Law Professor Christopher Elmendorf about Governor Newsom's proposed plans to build big infrastructure projects faster by amending environmental laws. Okay, big infrastructure projects. What projects is the governor talking about? What are some examples?
So one project that he's talking about is this very controversial project to move additional water from the Sacramento Bay Delta to other parts of the state that need water. Again, there are people who've been thinking about this problem for 30 years. I don't have a strong view on it one way or another myself, and so I don't really want to speak to that. But beyond that Delta project, he's talking about solar farms. He's talking about vehicle charging stations. He's talking about increasing electrical transmission capacity, which is absolutely essential as we electrify the economy and move away from fossil fuel based energy. He's also potentially talking about investments in technology infrastructure that may be enabled through the Federal CHIPS Act, which is supposed to help to develop a domestic semiconductor industry. And he's talking about some transportation projects, which may include additional mass transit of one form or another, or and maybe in some ways might also include highway projects.
Given that these changes that you're talking about, I mean, when we're talking about big infrastructure, it doesn't include housing. Why not streamline the process to build more housing in California? We need it.
Yes, I think that's an obvious omission from the governor's proposal. And I don't know what explains that omission, particularly given that it's something that he himself has highlighted in previous comments about the problems with CEQA. I will say as well that there's no effort in this proposal to identify a class of projects that are presumptively environmentally beneficial and therefore should undergo lesser environmental reviews. So you might say infill housing or housing in areas near transportation, like trains or fixed transit, that those should be exempt from CEQA or streamlined. Or you might say that electrical transmission projects, if they're using existing right-of-ways, should be streamlined because we know we need more electrical transmission. And if we're not building a new right-of-way, that's minimal environmental impact. Or you might say solar farms in areas that are already environmentally disturbed, like an agricultural field, as opposed to a wildland or natural area, those should be deemed to be presumptively beneficial for the environment and not subject to environmental review. And the governor's own resources agency, along with the Office of Planning and Research, has authority to create exemptions for environmentally benign projects under the California Environmental Quality Act. Now, there are some legal questions about the scope of that authority exactly, but I think it's a really striking omission that nothing in this executive order directs the governor's own people to use their existing authority to reduce the burdens of environmental review on presumptively beneficial projects.
On the topic of exemptions, I mean, the governor also noted in his announcements that sports stadiums, I mean, they are able to gain exemptions from CEQA in order to be built more quickly. How are stadiums able to bypass CEQA hurdles?
Well, sports stadiums were the model for this governor stamp of approval CEQA expedited project. That the first versions of that idea were introduced to expedite CEQA review of sports stadiums, not to exempt sports stadiums entirely, but to limit delays. And I think if you ask politically, how are sports stadiums exempted? It was the combination of rich owners and labor unions who had agreements with those rich owners to use their workers to build their projects. And that was that combination is a really potent force in Sacramento. The same coalition doesn't exist when you're talking about the need to build tens of thousands of small projects, be they small housing projects or small electricity projects. And so for those types of projects, the politics are a little different. And I think because of that, we haven't seen the same progress.
Finally, Professor Elmendorf, you know, when the government made this announcement, I mean, he made it clear that of the $180 billion over the next decade, much of that money would come from the federal government. And then he posed the question, like, are we going to screw it up by being consumed by paralysis and process? And on Twitter, you actually answered by saying, probably so. That doesn't sound very optimistic. Are you optimistic?
Again, I also said that I thought the governor's proposal was a baby step in the right direction. So I think it's good that the conversation is moving in this way. I am not sure that the governor is willing or able to kill any sacred cows that presently stand in the way of bringing down costs and reducing the paralysis by analysis. But, you know, we'll see how the proposal is received. We'll see what the legislature does with it. And incrementally, we may be making progress. And I don't think anybody should, incremental progress is better than none at all. And there are not enough people who are engaged with politics these days who appreciate incremental progress.
Yeah, it's heading in the right direction, possibly. So, Professor Elmendorf, thank you so much for the conversation. We could talk about CEQA forever, for an eternity.
We can be paralyzed by it. Yes, thank you.
Exactly. Christopher Elmendorf is a professor of law at UC Davis with an emphasis in land use and property law. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
We'll be right back.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The Strawberry Music Festival begins this weekend in Nevada County. The multi-day festival features camping and concerts for all ages. This annual event has been going on for decades, bringing together musicians and music lovers from all walks of life to enjoy a diverse lineup of folk, bluegrass, Americana, and roots music. Set against the backdrop of a lush 100-acre conifer forest, the festival began in 1982. Willie T. Taylor is a local act who will be performing at the festival, and he joins us to talk about his music. We're also joined by Rita Hoskin, who's been a camper, a volunteer, and now is the master of ceremonies for the Strawberry Music Festival, about how it's become a beloved tradition for both locals and visitors alike. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
What a treat. What a great way to end the show. So, Willie, I want to start with you. You're one of the acts that's going to be performing. You were born in Oakdale in the San Joaquin Valley, raised in this area. How did California shape and influence your music?
I come from a long line of cattle ranchers, and the Golden Hills, it's everything I just have ever known, and the Stanislaus River, and that's just what my song, where my songs come from, I guess.
We're going to listen to one of your songs. It's actually titled California, and it has, like, you know, elements of rock, blues, folk, and country. What's the background on the song? What inspired you?
Mostly John Steinbeck, The Grapes of Wrath, and the Dust Bowl, and how that big movement, I got kind of obsessed with it, and just the strife. But everyone still kept coming. Because of California, the hope that California had. It's interesting.
Well, let's take a quick listen.
Head out to California. We can sit by the sea. All eat like kings as we shade in them trees. Redwoods air.
All right. Well, this is just a taste of what people are in store for this weekend. What a treat. What do you love about performing at the Strawberry Music Festival?
When I was 18 years old, I'm 47 now, I finally made it to the Strawberry Music Festival up in Camp Mather. And I saw a guy named Greg Brown play. And I had no idea what I was going to do in life. And I had that come to Jesus moment where I was like, I need to learn how to play music because that's what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. And here I am.
Well, thank goodness for that.
Yeah,
I'm glad you had that epiphany.
And Strawberry's such a fun place late at night. Everybody's always playing. And so I cut my teeth and learned about jam circles and jam busters and like everything, you know, it's just basically a power camp to learn how to be a musician.
You know, Rita, as I mentioned, I mean, you attended the festival as a camper, a performer, a volunteer. You're now going to be the master of ceremonies. What brings you back every year?
You know, I love the story Willie tells because it really, to me, exemplifies why we keep coming back. And it's that inspiration. It's every time my family would leave, and it's a really family-friendly festival. You know, you can go with your kids. There's kid activities and teen activities and so on. And you can stay up all night jamming.
Yeah.
Every time my family left, we felt like we were inspired to make some big change in our lives, always for the better.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah. And it's like it was always a taste twice a year of how the world could be.
Mm.
And it was like its own utopia.
Absolutely. I did these crew member spotlights. I interviewed some longtime crew members in the last year, and one of the things they kept coming back with was how they felt like Strawberry was more than a festival, and more than a camp out. It was a community where you could relax, you could be yourself, you could be inspired, you could not feel not threatened, you know, and just relax and be comfortable.
How did it start in 1982? Do you know?
You know, there are a little group of founders. Charlie Cran is the one who lasted a long time and still is there. Bill Perry, Dan DeWayne, John Melrose. And a number of them were friends in Modesto. They played high school sports together or knew each other at Chico State.
Yeah, and went to Chico State.
Yeah.
I think that's where it was created. Maybe they thought of throwing something together. And it was actually in the Leland Meadows, a town of Strawberries, where it first started.
Yeah, that was the first year. And then right after that, it moved to Mayor.
Yeah, I think everyone was like, oh, this is going to be cool.
What's special about Nevada County to be home to a festival like this? I love Nevada County. But for people who haven't been there, what is it about this place, this place in the foothills, that is just the great foundation to make a beloved tradition come back year after year after year?
Yeah, well, you know, we had our home base there at Mather for so long. When we left after the Rim Fire, we were really looking for some place that could support us, not only by being a beautiful place, you know, 100 acres of conifers and meadows and gorgeous area and the rivers nearby, but also being a place that embraced art and music. And that the community there is really strong, and they've got, you know, they've got KVMR radio station. We've got our own Hog Radio, Pirate Radio station, and they work together a lot. It was a natural fit, really.
Yeah, and at nighttime, you don't know where you're at. It feels like Mather. And it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
That life can be anywhere, you know, and that it just feels great there.
Yeah.
So if it's someone's first time going this weekend, it can be wonderfully overwhelming, I imagine, right? Because you got a lot to take in. How do you recommend people kind of walk through the music festival over the weekend?
Get a good afternoon nap because nighttime's fun.
Totally. Yeah. And, you know, talk to your neighbors. We have something called the Strawberry Way, and it's real. It's not, you know, just something in the clouds. It's this ethos of kindness and cooperation and consideration for one another.
And sharing, mm-hmm. you know, food and drink. It's so fun to go just camp to camp. It's my favorite thing in the world.
Yeah, everybody says we wish it could be Strawberry all the time.
Yep.
Everybody's so nice to one another.
I just love seeing both of your faces light up when you're talking
I'm
about
the
music.
I'm pretty
excited.
It's been a while since I've been back, so I'm very excited, especially to play.
Oh,
I was born there, you know, in my music. So it's I'm honored.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, just getting a taste of what you're going to be performing. People are certainly in for a treat. Thank you both so much for joining us. I mean, I don't think I need to say this, but have a great time.
Yeah. Are you going to make it?
I would love to, but I'm actually going to be out of town. visiting my parents.
Maybe
next year, though. It sounds great, and it's a short drive away.
Yep. Right? We still have tickets for anybody interested. We got camping tickets.
Oh, that's and we have more information on our Insight page, too. So an easy click away for people who want to go. And I can see a lot of people wanting to go this weekend. That is Willie T. Taylor, who's going to be performing at the Strawberry Music Festival, and the Master of Ceremonies, Rita Hosking. We're going to close with more music from Willie T. Taylor. This song is called You Found Me. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Have a great day. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
And I try to read to fall asleep. I guess that's why I always drink, just so I don't have to think about my dirty dishes in the sink. And you
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.